from Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Elections are set for a number of Latin American nations that could impact the direction the region follows over the next few years. Brazil, the largest economy in the Western Hemisphere after the United States and number six globally, along with Bolivia and Uruguay, will choose new presidents next month. All three countries are part of the movement over the past decade towards regional integration and the pursuit of a course of independent development outside the influence of the United States. But only one incumbent president, President Evo Morales of Bolivia, appears to be a shoo-in for another term. We have this report from Telesur.
And we go to Bolivia, where Friday the presidential campaign kicks off. Campaign law will allow candidates to begin their campaigns Friday and continue until the election. State-run media are mandated to publish all parties' ads free of charge. Polls suggest a landslide re-election for current president Evo Morales, the country's first president from Bolivia's indigenous majority.
Uruguay's popular president, José Alberto Mujica, has served since 2010, but due to term limits, is unable to run again. And Brazil's president, Dilma Rousseff, is facing a vigorous campaign from a surprise challenger who came to the fore only after a plane crash took her party's former candidate, Eduardo Campos, out of the running about a month ago. We'll go into the details of both elections and discuss some of the global geopolitical context with our reporter from south of the border, Tony Solo, later in this newscast. Days after U.S. President Barack Obama unveiled plans to take action against targets in Syria without consulting with the Syrian government, forceful objections were voiced by Syria and its allies. Citing international law, Damascus, along with Russia and Iran, said that any attack against Syria would be considered under international law an act of aggression. We have this report from RT's Anastasia Cherkina.
Abiding by international law, in principle, is a very clear concept, but in reality, it's apparently fine to interpret liberally every once in a while. The U.S. did get asked for help by Iraq to fight against ISIS, also known as Islamic State.
The government of Iraq has invited the United States of America and asked for help. It has asked for help from the United States. It has asked for help from its neighbors, from other countries in the region. And under international law, when a country is invaded and a country invites somebody to come in and help them, we have every right in the world to respond to that request.
But no such request or approval of airstrikes ever came from Syria, whose territory the U.S. will now bomb, because there are Islamic State members there too.
Unfortunately, the president continues to talk about opposing President Assad, and frankly, Assad can be a big help, and I think along with Iran.
Another approval for airstrikes that was not requested was that of the U.S. Congress representing the American people. And while some Americans are accepting of this,
we need to eradicate terrorists wherever the terrorists are.
Others are not, having seen enough U.S. military action throughout recent years.
No.
What?
No. I don't think you should be bombing or dropping bombs on another sovereign country. Period. Unless they agree to it or ask you to.
In fact, the Syrian government has actually said any airstrikes would be considered an act of aggression.
The opinion of the international community, such as the UN Security Council, has also been nonchalantly brushed aside by Washington, while even America's key Western ally, Great Britain, has yet to announce what, if any, line of action it will be taking when it comes to the airstrikes over Syria.
Just because we see something that's horrific doesn't necessarily mean that our elected leaders or our government knows best how to deal with it. So sometimes it's better to take a step back.
But taking a step back when it comes to military escapades in the Middle East is a position the U.S. has proven not to be a fan of, with yet another military action plan raising more concerns than potentially being a solution.
From the legitimacy of striking over Syria without the approval of Damascus, the U.S. Congress, or any international body, to the scope, timeline, and consequences of the newly announced operations to come in the Middle East, Washington shows yet again that it will act how it wants, when it wants to, not necessarily applying to itself the standards it so often preaches to others. Anastasia Cherkina, RT, New York.
For its part, Syria has pledged to cooperate with the UN in dealing with the group known alternately as ISIL, ISIS, and the Islamic State. Press TV's Alaa Ibrahim reports from Damascus.
A busy day for the new United Nations envoy to Syria. The man who comes with the impossible mission to end the crisis that has claimed around 200,000 lives since 2011. The UN official met with the Syrian president along with other Syrian officials and the internal opposition in a bid to restart the stalemate political process that has seen little change over the past year.
Fighting terrorism without an acceleration of a political process that will lead to a different type of security situation and also well-being for the normal families in Syria certainly becomes for us a priority too. The two things are hand in hand.
Mistura also met with ambassadors of regional and international powers in Damascus, as the Syrian crisis is becoming more and more a regional concern.
We continue to support the work of the United Nations to reach a political solution.
Meantime, on the streets of Damascus, attention shifted from the visit to wait for the American attacks against ISIL in Syria that the American president promised in his speech.
Western and Arab aid to the Syrian insurgents helped ISIL grow and become stronger, and now they say they want to fight it without cooperating with the Syrian government, nor the Iranians or Russians. And I find that hard to accomplish. Eventually, they will re-enter the Middle East under this pretext.
Obama's strategy is to bomb ISIL, Takfiri terrorists, and ramp up military support for the Syrian opposition comes at a time when the Syrian Foreign Minister Walid al-Muallim has warned that any airstrikes on Syrian territory without Damascus consent would be considered an act of aggression. Ala Ibrahim, Press TV, Damascus.
And while much of the U.S. military aid sent to Iraq's government has ended up in the hands of ISIL, ISIS, the Islamic State, apparently there's still a belief in Washington that the recently announced funding for groups fighting the Syrian government will stay in the hands of the so-called moderate, that is, U.S.-backed opposition. But there are deep contradictions in the various relationships between a number of regional U.S. allies and ISIS and other terrorist groups. In particular, U.S. allies Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and Kuwait have been accused of funding or otherwise aiding a number of such terrorist groups in both Syria and Iraq, while Turkey, a NATO member, has provided safe haven and, in some cases, air support for groups fighting the Syrian government. This was the president's press secretary, Josh Earnest, at the Friday White House press conference.
Yesterday, Turkey didn't sign on to the communique out of in Saudi Arabia expressing support for confronting Islamic State. There have been concerns also about whether Kuwait and Qatar are doing enough to prevent fundraising for extremist groups. Is the White House satisfied with the level of commitment it is getting from certain allies in the Middle East in dealing and confronting Islamist groups?
Jim, I'm pleased that you mentioned the communique, because I do think that there are a couple of important things about it. You know, the first is it's important for people to understand that the communique was signed by ministers representing states of the Gulf Coast Cooperation Council, or the Gulf Cooperation Council, Egypt, Iraq, Jordan, Lebanon, and of course the United States. And in the context of this communique, each of those organizations and countries declares, quote, their shared commitment to stand united against the threat posed by all terrorism, including the so-called Islamic State in Iraq and the Levant, to the region and the world. Over the course of the communique, they lay out their commitment to, quote, do their share in the comprehensive fight against ISIL, including, and then they list several things, and it ends with, as appropriate, joining in the many aspects of the coordinated military campaign against ISIL. That is an early indication of the interest that the United States is seeing from our partners in the region in presenting a united front to the terrorists in ISIL. There is a strong commitment from these countries in the region to working with the international community to deny ISIL the kind of safe haven that would pose a significant threat to countries in the region, but also countries around the world. This will continue to be an ongoing effort to build support, to identify needs, and to identify the specific capabilities of countries where they could meet the needs of the broader coalition. So this is difficult work, but the president, as he indicated in his news conference at the NATO summit at the end of last week, has been pleased with the reception that we have gotten from our partners and allies around the world as it relates to their willingness to engage in the efforts of this international coalition to degrade and ultimately destroy ISIL.
But any disappointment that particularly Turkey, a NATO member, would not sign on to something like this?
Well, as you mentioned, each country has their own specific set of interests that are related to this specific situation. There is no doubt, and we have seen this both in private comments from Turkish officials, but also in public comments from Turkish officials, that they are concerned, and rightly so, about the instability and violence that has been created by ISIL. This is obviously all occurring right on the doorstep of Turkey, and they are rightly concerned. I understand that the Secretary of State is actually there today, I believe, to meet with Turkish officials and his counterparts. The President had the opportunity to visit with President Erdogan at the NATO summit last week. Secretary of Defense Chuck Hagel was in Turkey at the beginning of this week. So that's an indication of the thorough consultation that is underway between the United States and Turkey to discuss with them what role they can play and how they can contribute to this broader international coalition. We certainly welcome the partnership and alliance that we have with Turkey and look forward to their efforts to join with the international community to meet this threat.
Aside from providing safe haven to a number of terrorist groups fighting the Syrian government, Turkey has also been host to a large number of Syrian refugees seeking escape from war in their country. Those refugees are part of a group of displaced Syrians that now numbers about 10 million out of a total population of 23 million before hostilities began in February 2011. According to the United Nations Refugee Agency, more than 3 million Syrians have left the country altogether, and another 6.5 million are internally displaced. Warda Al-Zawahiri reports from the United Nations.
Iman is a single mother to a 15-year-old daughter. She also looks after her disabled sister. When the conflict started, she fled from place to place inside Syria.
I had two girls with me, one disabled, so I simply couldn't stay. I ran from one place to the other. I was fleeing between towns. We'd find a place to stay, then fighting and bombing followed, and many people died. I would wait an hour until it is quiet, then flee once again.
Iman was displaced no fewer than four times inside the country. When her life savings dried up, Iman faced a stark choice: stay and die or leave the country.
We couldn't take it anymore. From being hungry to being cold, being under siege, being bombarded all the time. We saw people die in front of our eyes because of the bombing from both sides. We could no longer stay in Syria. We couldn't take it. Me, my brother, my daughter, and sister simply couldn't take it anymore.
Thousands of Syrians have lived similar stories. Today, the number of Syrians who fled their country is set to reach 3 million. Syrians are now the world's largest refugee population under UNHCR care, second only in number to the decades-long Palestinian crisis. The Syria operation is now the largest in UNHCR's 64-year history. Neighboring countries and humanitarian agencies struggle to keep up. Iman paid $200 for transport and paperwork she needed to leave the country. The family now survives on cash assistance and food vouchers provided by aid agencies. But Iman longs for the day that she can go back home to Syria.
It's our country no matter what. Who wouldn't miss their country? Who wouldn't miss their home, the ground they walked on? No one could forget their country. We were raised in Syria, lived there. How can we not love it?
There are now 3 million refugees who share Iman's hardship and pain. Leaving was their last resort. Now they face an uncertain future and a long wait to go home.
And while the widely publicized video images of the group known as ISIL, ISIS, and Islamic State chopping off the heads of a pair of American journalists has reportedly led to a surge in the polls for military action against the group, the real head choppers, those with the largest head count, literally, are Washington's closest allies. Black Agenda Radio's Glenn Ford has more.
President Obama has declared war on ISIS, the renegade jihadists that have turned on their former masters in NATO and the royal courts of Arabia. Nearly four decades ago, the U.S., Saudi Arabia, and Pakistan spent billions to create from scratch an international jihadist network to torment a left-wing government in Afghanistan. The ragtag feudal Islamist raiders that once delighted in beheading young Afghan leftists who were sent to the countryside to carry out land reform and teach village girls to read now yearn to detach the skulls of Saudi kings and princes from their obscenely rich bodies and to methodically drive the Western infidels from all Muslim territories. This is indeed some deep poetry. Until the advent of ISIS, Saudi Arabia led the world in executions by beheading, often leaving the decapitated bodies on display in public squares. The Saudis have hired American public relations outfits to plant articles in the U.S. corporate press, disavowing any connection between the royal family and its wayward children in ISIS and other Al-Qaeda offshoots, while at the same time stepping up the pace of their own beheadings. In the New York Times, no less, two frontmen for the Saudi royal family wrote that the king's regime is best suited to drive ISIS into oblivion, which is yet more proof that the Saudi royals are feeling the nearness of cold steel to their own necks. The logic of jihad inevitably calls for a caliphate, and for the believer, a caliphate trumps a fat king and his 5,000 corrupt little princes any day. Emirs in the United Arab Emirates also shake in their well-crafted boots, fearing the wrath of the faithful. The Royal Arabian Fat Cats, who, along with the U.S., have funded the proxy war against Syria for the last 3 years, are now embroiled in a proxy war against each other in both Syria and Libya. The Saudis and Egypt's military dictator, Abdel el-Sisi, are arrayed against the Emir of Qatar and the aristocrats in Kuwait, who continue to fund the renegade jihadists. The United States has sided with their long-term partners, the Saudis, who have more oil, and are pressuring Qatar and Kuwait to stop funding ISIS and its friends. When the oil-rich monarchies are in disarray and at each other's throats, Washington also panics. That's why Obama seems so indecisive. His options become fewer and fewer. The U.S. wants to get on with regime change in Syria, but ISIS has even bigger plans for regime change in the Arab world, including lopping off the heads of America's friends. But Washington will not give up its dirty war against Syria. Instead, Obama is attempting to merge that war with the fight against ISIS by somehow making stupid Americans believe that Syrian President Assad is secretly allied with the same jihadists that have been beheading Syrian soldiers and civilians since 2011. It's a very, very big lie, but Americans are incredibly willing to believe anything, no matter how ridiculous, about Arabs and black people. And who is best to tell such lies than the first black president? Just give Obama George Bush's script, and somehow it all sounds different, which is so damn sick it makes you want to laugh your head off. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford.
Friday marked 37 years since South African student leader Stephen Biko was killed at the age of 30. Biko was an early proponent of the Black Consciousness Movement. Although the police claimed his death on September 12, 1977, while in police custody, was the result of an extended hunger strike, an autopsy revealed he had suffered multiple bruises and abrasions and ultimately succumbed to a brain hemorrhage from massive head injuries. After a 15-day inquest in 1978, a magistrate judge found there was not enough evidence to charge the officers with murder because there were no eyewitnesses. Based on the evidence given at the inquest, the Attorney General of the Eastern Cape stated he would not prosecute. The following year, the attorney for Biko's family announced that the South African government would pay them $78,000 in compensation for Biko's death. The Truth and Reconciliation Commission, created following the end of minority rule and the apartheid system, reported that five former members of the South African security forces who had admitted to killing Biko were applying for amnesty. While their application was rejected in 1999, on October 7th of 2003, the South African Justice Ministry announced that it would not prosecute the officers because of insufficient evidence and due to the statute of limitations for prosecution having lapsed. Although the official abolition of apartheid occurred in 1991 with the repeal of the last of the remaining apartheid laws, non-whites were not allowed to vote until 1993, and the end of apartheid is widely regarded as arising from the 1994 Democratic general elections. The eyes of the world will be on elections in Latin America next month in Bolivia, Brazil, and Uruguay, while Bolivian President Evo Morales appears well-positioned to take another term. The outcome of elections in both Brazil and Uruguay will apparently be a lot harder to predict. In the case of Brazil, which is a member of the BRICS group, there are implications for the future of the multipolar world that has begun to take shape over the past few years. For more on this and other news and events in the lands south of El Rio Grande, we go to our reporter from south of the border, Tony Solo.
The main news here in the region continues to be the election campaign in Brazil. The first round of the elections are going to be on October the 6th. And it looks as though, and the trend in the polls, and there are three main candidates. There's a guy called Neves, who's an out-and-out right-winger. Right. There's Dilma Rousseff, who's the incumbent president representing the Workers' Party, which is a broadly progressive political movement that has managed to stay in power over the last 15 years or so by means of political alliances with other smaller parties. And there's this woman, Marina Silva, who's come to the fore since the tragic death of Eduardo Campos, the candidate of the Socialist Party. Right. And she's a kind of closet right-winger. She's a closet neoliberal, but becoming much less a closet neoliberal and coming more and more out into the open as the electoral campaign progresses. And as the electoral campaign progresses and her policies become clearer and clearer, she seems to be losing ground.
Yeah, Dilma's moving up. I saw that. That's a relief. I hope the hell she wins this, because Brazil is that election is very important in the context. You know, if you look at the global regional integration process that's going on, Brazil is a key player as a member of BRICS, as the largest economy in Latin America, and as one of the more forward members of the BRICS countries in terms of its political and economic orientation.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of one can argue about around the position of Brazil and South Africa and India in terms of the strength of their commitment to developing an alternative. I think there's no question at all that Dilma Rousseff and her colleague, former President Lula Ignacio da Silva, their commitment to building a multipolar world is absolutely clear, and that's one of the reasons why the United States, in particular the George Soros circle, are so anxious to promote the candidacy of Marina Silva. And at the moment, it looks as though Dilma Rousseff would win on the first round, and then but not by enough to win outright. The elections would then go to a second round, which I think would happen in early November. Mm. Then the chances are that there'd be a very close runoff between her and Marina Silva. That's how things look like at the moment. Obviously, that's very likely to change over the next couple of weeks.
You know,
and then there's another important election going on in in Uruguay, and there's the same theme there. You have a relatively progressive government, not by any stretch of the imagination as progressive, for example, Evo Morales in Bolivia or Rafael Correa in Ecuador, right, or Nicolas Maduro in Venezuela or Daniel Ortega in Nicaragua. But I'm there, still a progressive party, very, very much along the lines of the Workers' Party in Brazil, from what I understand.
Right.
And they're up against a very similar figure to Marina Silva, a young candidate called Luis Lacalle Pou, I think is the way his surname's pronounced, P-O-U. And he represents the right wing in Uruguay, young candidate, attractive candidate, up against an older, I think, Tabaré Vázquez, who's the candidate of the ruling Frente Amplio party. Mm. Perhaps we should explain that Jose Mujica can't stand for re-election because
right,
that's
term
prohibited.
Limits, yeah.
Under the Uruguay constitution. So you've got Tiny Luis Lacalle Pou saying, you know, we're for change. I'm a young face. I've got new policies, but they're only new in the context of the last 5 or 10 years.
Right.
They're the same policies that submerged Uruguay in all kinds of economic problems, in particular for the relatively impoverished majority.
Yeah, neo-neoliberalism.
Yeah, yeah. Right. Yeah. So and that's Marina Silva's pitch in the Brazilian elections. And yeah, we've had 15 years of the Workers' Party. It's time for a change. I'm a new candidate with new policies. Vote for me. And that's. Right. And so you have that trend, and I'm quite optimistic that that trend will be defeated.
Yeah.
But there is a discussion among the broad Latin American progressive left, if you like, that the Latin America may be facing a kind of neoconservative or conservative restoration.
Well, here's the key here, I believe, looking at this, and having seen it elsewhere, but particularly right now in Brazil and Uruguay, you have one thing that you have in Brazil, for example, is a substantial and growing, under the present conditions, constituency for this new direction, for the regional integration, for the democratizing of the economy, for the application of economic product to developing the values of the people. That whole trend is there's a growing constituency for that in Brazil, and they are represented on the national stage with, whether necessary or intended, concessions by Rousseff. And the other side, the restoration of the right wing, essentially, rides behind those candidates. And those are the things that are going to develop within the society, depending on what the outcome is.
Yeah, and of course, what Soros and his CIA circle and his kind of that whole network that is so pernicious in terms of its effect in international affairs. And what they're trying to do is to divide the Workers' Party's natural constituency, and I think that's why they're so keen on Marina Silva, because right. she has this green. She pictures herself as an environmentalist, and of course the environmental issues are very, very important in Brazil. And so I think there's less chance that the Uruguayan right wing will defeat the Frente Amplio in Uruguay than that Marina Silva will perhaps come to power in Brazil. And I hope she doesn't. But the strategy that she's implementing is. In many ways, it's the strategy that Daniel Ortega used in Nicaragua, and he divided the right-wing opposition and came to power with a minority government and consolidated his base through his first government's policies.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.